From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Many political pundits thought that the presidential primaries would be over effectively by this point, that the rush by many states to hold their contest early would decide the nominees quickly. That hasn't turned out to be the case. In fact, for the Democratic Party, there's been the exact opposite effect. The race has tightened over time, and the people who may have the most influence are the late voting states and the superdelegates. Hundreds of Democratic elected officials and party leaders hold superdelegate status, among them the members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina is the majority whip in the U.S. House of Representatives. He hasn't stated a preference for either candidate. He joins us now. Representative Clyburn, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your state, South Carolina, was pivotal in the race, and its Democratic primary was called informally by some folks the Black primary because Black voters made up more than 40% of the Democratic electorate. So this was a moment also when comments by former President Bill Clinton helped to activate the issue of race directly in the campaign. And Barack Obama won your state. You have remained studiously neutral. Where are you today?
I still remain studiously neutral. I think that the historical significance of so-called superdelegates, these are unpledged delegates, is very, very important for us to maintain. We are in place in order to either extend the wishes of the voters or to try to make corrections if they need to be made.
Our contributor, Donna Brazile, who's also a longtime Democratic Party insider, ran the presidential campaign of former Vice President Al Gore, has said she will just up and leave the Democratic Party if the superdelegates are used to broker a convention and that it's not the committed delegates who've come as a part of the voting process who get to make the decision. How do you react to that? Someone who's so passionate about the Democratic Party but is absolutely against the superdelegates deciding.
She's in a big club, a club that I think would be overflowing at their meetings if that were to happen. I don't think anything like that will come close to being to happening. Here's the deal. We all know the Democrats, we have what we call proportional voting. So if we have votes in these primaries that are proportional, and then you get to the end of the process, and you're still not at the magic number of 2025, which will be 50% plus one, what do you do? Well, that's when the superdelegates step in. They step in to extend the voters' will, not to reverse it.
But even if someone has that magic number, the superdelegates could throw it the other way.
That's not what I said. I said they will not reverse it. I'm saying the superdelegates will step in to extend the will of the people.
So it could happen. It could happen mathematically, but you're saying you don't think it will happen.
No, that's not what we are. We are here to do for the National Democratic Party what United States Congress people ought to do.
Congressman, let me ask you just on a personal level. Former President Bill Clinton is calling people. Senator Clinton is calling people. Senator Obama is calling people. Have any of those individuals called you recently and asked for your support as a superdelegate?
I don't think I've talked to President Clinton. Yes, we did talk a week after the South Carolina primary. I have not talked to him since then. I have not talked to Senator Clinton since the primary. I'm trying to think. I may have talked to Obama. I've talked to all of their people, but I've not talked to them personally.
Give me an example of something that one of the candidates has said, and you don't have to say which one, one of the candidates' proxies or supporters has said to try to swing you one way or the other.
Oh, they remind me of what the voters did in my congressional district, wanting to know whether or not I'm ready to reflect the will of my congressional district to further Obama's interest, and there's some people who want to know that, to see whether or not I've got enough guts to vote the other way. And I can tell you, I do have enough guts to vote the other way if I thought that was in the necessary, that was in the interest of the nationalizing our party. And I think that's what my voters would want me to do. You know, a lot of things can change after the primary. I don't know why people keep dealing with that. Next week, something might jump out that's serious, and even that would cause some of the people to rethink how they cast their votes on February the 5th. We already have people who are super delegates who are now rethinking their commitments that they made 2 and 3 months ago. Because of the circumstances have changed.
Speaking of which, Representative John Lewis of Georgia endorsed Senator Clinton, and recently the New York Times said he had moved his support to Senator Obama. He is saying that that is not what he said, but they quoted him saying, something is happening in America and people are prepared and ready to make that great leap. He's again saying he is not casting his superdelegate vote for Senator Obama, but he is reassessing the situation. Does that show the huge amount of pressure that's particularly on members of the Congressional Black Caucus who've been split in their endorsements?
Well, yes, that's true. Congressman David Scott, who represents the district, congressional district adjacent to John's, has flat out switched. He's made it very clear. He is switching to reflect the will of his voters. I think Obama got 80% in his district. I've read that two other superdelegates have now said they're moving to the uncommitted column who had been previously committed to Senator Clinton, and another one has since switched. Remember, a lot of these people made their commitments 10 months ago, even a year ago, when everybody was getting ready for a coronation. They now see that it's not going to be a coronation. So everybody, in order to reflect what their current emotions are.
Do you think this whole issue of who gets to decide could tear the party apart as opposed to uniting it?
It could just as soon unite it, too. Yes, it could. This is a very, very unusual election year, and nobody could have anticipated any of what has happened.
Well, Congressman, we thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina is the majority whip of the U.S. House of Representatives. Now we're going to take this discussion of politics and other breaking news to the members of our Reporters Roundtable. Joining me now are Aaron Aubrey Kaplan of the Los Angeles Times, Katie Rechtall of the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and Chandra Thomas of Atlanta Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks.
So we just heard Congressman James Clyburn argue that superdelegates have an important role in choosing the Democratic nominee. And as you guys talk to folks in your areas, in the field, how do they feel about that idea that superdelegates could decide the election? Katie, are you hearing anything either from political officials or from citizens?
I think political officials feel like it's a nice little argument, that it's a nice wonky argument to have. But the average citizen that I've been talking to feels like either superdelegates are something they just don't want to even bother with right now, or else it's something that yet again could rig sort of the election in a way when they thought that they were in a democratic process. So I think it's the discussion, the real discussion, I think, will come as we get closer and closer to the convention. It becomes clear how much they're going to play a role.
Aaron, the members of the Congressional Black Caucus seem divided, some of them divided over their own commitments that they made before.
Right.
How do you think this is going to affect the race?
That's a really good question. This all seems so fluid. I think that I agree with Katie. The folks here, people on the ground, are not talking about superdelegates at all. They're talking about the race and Obama's growing momentum, the M word, seems to be real. And that seems death-consuming people. The fact that, for example, our representative out here, Maxine Waters, has endorsed Clinton, for one, no one seems to be paying any attention to that. Our local black paper here, the LA Sentinel, has completely endorsed Obama. And that's what everyone's focused on. And I think people are still rather confused about the role of superdelegates. They, as the congressman explained, they reflect the will of the people. But if the will of the people is not all that clear, what happens then? We're still not sure what role they'll play.
And when you look at Georgia, Chandra, you're at Atlanta Magazine, there has been a lot of talk about John Lewis, and the question is whether or not John Lewis is actually going to switch his support to the Obama campaign. How do people there feel, given that John Lewis's district went 3-1 for Obama?
Well, I've actually received a petition via email where several people were actually vying for Congressman Lewis to change his vote. And I think that speaks to the will of the people, and I think that what they're saying is they want the congressman to respond to the will of his constituents.
It seems like a lot of the action on this is coming out of the South, coming out of the traditional black voting districts in the South. How plugged in are Atlantans this time around to the presidential election?
Oh, my gosh. It is just insane. And I think that's what's so exciting is this is the first time that a lot of people who are not in the political game are actually interested at all of the process. And everywhere I go, I see Obama signs, and I just hear a lot of discussion, and especially with the whole civil rights aspect here, a lot of people have been concerned, and they feel that the civil rights leaders have sort of turned their back on Obama, and especially having spent so many years focusing on race, and they kind of feel like this is your chance to support a black man, and they feel like there's a lot of sentiment that that people are being very political and not taking this opportunity.
Well, we're definitely going to talk more politics always, but I want to get to some local issues, to the issue of the FEMA trailers. But we have to take a short break first, so stay with us, Aaron, Katie, and Chandra. This is our Reporters Roundtable. We are speaking with Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, who writes for the L.A. Times opinion page, Katie Rechdahl, who reports for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and Chandra Thomas, who writes for Atlanta Magazine. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're back for more of our Reporters Roundtable. I'm with Aaron Aubrey Kaplan of the L.A. Times, Katie Rechdahl of the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and Chandra Thomas of Atlanta Magazine. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So I want to talk about some presidential politics in a second, but first, News and Notes has kept an eye on folks living in FEMA trailers in New Orleans and Mississippi. We heard last fall that high levels of formaldehyde were a threat in those trailers. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control says the levels are so high that occupants need to be relocated. And Katie, you have been on the ground reporting on this story. What do we know about this situation?
Well, last fall there was a big push by FEMA to get a lot of the residents from the FEMA trailer parks here in New Orleans out in a very quick manner. They were giving notice in 30 days notice, weren't helping a lot of people find apartments in a really tight, affordable housing market. There was a lot of speculation there that it was because of the formaldehyde and that was what was moving people out so quickly. So I don't think it comes as a lot of surprise to people that the formaldehyde levels, that the tests show how high they are. One of the things that I note is that the tests were done in December when the temperatures are lower and the formaldehyde levels tend to be higher in warmer weather. So I think in the middle of the summer, we probably were in deep trouble here. And we were I know that local advocates here were trying to get those trailers tested and just could not get them tested. So there's a lot of suspicion about what exactly FEMA knew and when.
Chandra, when you think about this story, which has not affected Atlanta or Georgia directly, but certainly in the sense of southern states looking at New Orleans and what has happened post-Katrina, is there a sense of sadness that these troubles continue?
Yeah, actually, Atlanta is one of the top places that a lot of Katrina victims moved to. And I think that people are very disappointed, and I think that they feel that this has been a very just a disturbing, I guess the Katrina situation just seems to get worse and worse, and it just seems like it's kind of shed this light kind of on the government and how they respond to issues.
Aaron, is this issue going to play out more nationally, or is this something, in your opinion, that's going to be more localized? I mean, Katrina has gone on and off the radar many times. John Edwards, who has officially not dropped out of the race, but who has suspended his campaign, made a big deal of going down to New Orleans, and many of the candidates have. But is this still playing big on the national screen?
Oh, I think so. In Los Angeles, there's a huge contingent of New Orleans transplants. My family is one of them. So it's been watched very closely with what's happening in Louisiana. And also the publisher of the local African-American paper, the L.A. Sentinel, is from New Orleans. So there's a lot of interest in what goes on. And, it's just another unfortunate symbol of what's happened or not happened since Katrina. It's been, more than 2 years now? And it's like adding injury to insult. The trailers, which were inadequate to begin with, which people were being forced to leave anyway, are now, you know, now we know that they are, you know, potentially lethal. And it's just, you know, one more piece of evidence that the government and, is simply not on top of this and continues to not be on top of it. And so we have another potential problem we'll have to deal with if we ever deal with it. It's all very, you know, frustrating, to say the least.
Katie, how are people thinking about engaging in the political process at this point, given how many local and regional problems there are? Do you get the sense that people from New Orleans are engaged around the presidential election?
I do. I mean, I think New Orleans is a very political town. And you know, when on election day, the green spaces between the streets, which we call neutral grounds, are crammed with election signs. So people are really engaged. A lot of, I think like every place else, there's just a lot of fervor and excitement about Obama.
I want to move on to some presidential politics. The president has scheduled a trip to Africa, and he plans to highlight his work on AIDS and malaria and to push a plan for good governance. He's using this visit to highlight the softer side of foreign policy. Aaron, why do you think that's the case?
Well, to kind of try to prove that there is a softer side to his foreign policy. I don't think a lot of people believe that. You know, even when he came out with his AIDS package back when he first became president, there were some, you know, many complaints at the time that it was just not enough. He has not been, to say the least, he's not been a presence in Africa. He hasn't been seen not to be concerned with it. When he went to, he's been visiting several countries in the last year. He went to the Middle East, and people just kind of shrug their shoulders and see him as a lame duck president who is just kind of putting out way too little, much too late.
Chandra, the president has said that he's willing to delay his trip to put his weight behind a plan to extend government surveillance, a program that's stuck in Congress. Now, Congress isn't even in session next week. Does that show a lack of commitment to really engaging with Africa, or is he just protecting his interest in this, you know, this fierce battle over wiretapping?
I think there's definitely a lot of sentiment that this trip is sort of for face value. And if you recall, he's actually delayed other trips to Africa kind of in the same sentiment. And I just think that some of it actually has to do with the current election is kind of creating this illusion that there is an interest in Africa. And also, I think he's trying to soften the blow of this perception that the Bush administration does not care about the international community. And that's obviously a lot of fallout during his administration. And I really feel that his constant attempt at pushing off the trip, it kind of contradicts the whole point of the trip, which is to show that you do care, but you have said that you would prefer to focus on your own bill and focus on this eavesdropping program.
Katie, when you look at the situation with the president's trip to Africa, you know, this bill has been associated, the bill in Congress has been associated with anti-terrorism efforts. Now the U.S. is looking at terrorism that's based on the continent of Africa. Do you think that that links together at all in terms of, you know, the foreign policy aspect also having an edge of anti-terrorism?
I think Bush likes to put anti-terrorism into everything. It's like his seasoning that he likes to put into everything. And I know that there's been speculation about whether he's specifically delaying this trip because it's Africa and he hasn't spent a lot of time or interest in Africa. But, I mean, I almost feel like he might even delay one of his Texas vacations to fight for wiretapping. He's just so crazy about terror, and his fervor on terror is so clear that I think that that's the story out of this, to me at least, that it's just he is willing to do almost anything to really fight for his particular point on terror.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Katie Rechtall reports for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Aaron Aubrey Kaplan writes for the Los Angeles Times opinion page. And Chandra Thomas writes for Atlanta Magazine. And they all join me by phone. As part of our month-long film series, today we're going to take a look at, or rather, take a listen to, the role of music in the movies. We're going to hear from two musical giants in the film score industry. First, Stanley Clarke. He's a legendary jazz bassist, orchestrator, conductor, and film score writer. He's composed music for more than 65 movies, including The Transporter and Boys in the Hood. In the 1970s, Stanley Clarke made a name for himself playing bass, but for the past 25 years, he's been turning his energy to film and television scoring. Clarke's now one of the most in-demand composers in Hollywood.
Many of the films that I do are very different from one another, but there was a period where I did a lot of action pictures, I've done a lot of television, I've done a lot of, there's a lot of films that have a lot of African Americans in it, I can say that. And with each film, you have to really approach differently.
What was your favorite? I mean, you've done so many dozens of scores, but what was your favorite either to work on or in terms of how it came out?
You mentioned What's Love Got to Do with It. That film I really like because, you know, it's a heck of a story, you know, and the music, it's a very thematic score. If you really listen to it and really pay close attention to the music, there's a theme that I must lay this theme over the picture maybe 10 or 15 times during the course of the picture. And the cool thing about it is that, you know, I spent a lot of time just working on that one short theme.
So when you look at how you broke into the business, being someone who was, you know, you are, but you were in a musician role and then you were asked to compose, is it hard for African Americans to break into that part of the business?
Yes, it's always going to be hard because, you know, we as human beings, we thrive on familiarity. You know, we like to, it's kind of, bit of it is sad commentary. Maybe it's getting better. I don't notice it so much because I'm just a jazz musician. I'm in my own world. But I think people tend to want to be with their own kind and all that. So I have to tell you a little story. I remember one time, I'm not going to tell you what film it was that I did. It was a popular film, but I walked into this room to meet these directors, and these guys thought I was a white guy before they saw me. And I walked in. And the look on their face, I mean, it was just kind of, it was a shocking moment, you know, but it kind of brought a smile to my face because, you know, I take my job very serious. I was very prepared, and I was really more anxious to find out what their reaction was going to be after they spoke to me. I didn't really care the fact that I walked in there and I had an afro and had these big shoes on. I was looking good. I didn't care so much about that, but and when I finished my meeting with them, they were impressed and they hired me. And I must say that when I was doing a lot of this early film composing, I have to tell you that I did have the thought like that I was kind of laying a trail there, you know, because I think at that time it was myself, Quincy Jones, Herbie Hancock, really a handful of film composers that had done, you know, significant work in Hollywood. Now, there's quite a few, and I feel like I was part of that. Also, at that time, there was a resurgence in black cinema. You know, Spike Lee, then John Singleton came along. I did John's first three films, and so it was a very unique time for me. And so it wasn't just me doing a film, getting paid, and going home. You know, there was something else there that sort of inspired me. I felt like I was trailblazing, and that's what I did.
How do you actually do this? I mean, do you start coming up with themes based on a script, or do you watch a rough cut? And how do you create something on a very practical level?
You know, we get a script, and you can start thinking about music, and you can even write music from a script. But I tend to like to watch the footage, then come up with the music. And from the point that you get the footage and then you start thinking about music, you go through something called a spotting session, meaning you have a session with the director, and he'll spot places where you want music. That's why it's called a spotting session. And once you finish that, from that point to getting a finished product with music was what I call, half of it is magic, and the other part is skill, like catching the human emotion. And I think that's the part you can't teach necessarily to people. I think you have to have some sort of, I would like to find another word, but I can't find it. There has to be a bit of humanity within your heart. You know, you have to have some understanding of people. I don't think a guy that's really has no understanding about people or has no interest in understanding people would make a good film composer, because in film, you know, you're dealing with all the dynamics of life. You know, one minute you can be dealing with love, the next minute somebody could be getting their head cut off, the next minute someone could be afraid to get their head cut off, the next minute could be a guy who regrets cutting the guy's head off. I mean, there's all these subtle emotions and different dynamics that you have to deal with, and somehow, you know, it has to go in your heart, and then from your heart it has to kind of come out in music.
There's a lot of musicians that are branching out and doing music for films. I think of the RZA. We were just talking about urban film, but he's a, you know, rap artist turned sometimes soundtrack composer. Do you see things moving in a particular artistic direction?
I think it's going to move in a lot of different directions. See, there's a lot of things happening. Number one, the directors now are younger, and they usually tend to want to have the music that they grew up with or music that they're into at that moment in their films. So for me, I'm kind of open. I think, you know, if you have some music in your soul and you're able to produce it however you can, you know, there's a musician there. I do miss, you know, the old days, you know, where you do a film, you get hired, and the guy says, write some music, and you write music, and you come back and you talk about that music, but not in relationship to a committee deciding based on something that some kids in Pasadena thought, you know. So, anyway.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating business.
Yeah.
Stanley Clark, thanks for talking to us.
All right.
That's jazz musician and film score composer Stanley Clark. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Now, if you've seen any of Spike Lee's movies, you'll probably recognize the music of Terrence Blanchard. You can hear his trademark trumpet on nearly 50 film scores from Barbershop to Malcolm X. As a young man, Terrence Blanchard left his hometown of New Orleans and headed to New York to make a name in jazz. After years of success, he moved on to composing film scores. Blanchard told me how he got involved in doing movie music.
I had been hired on, you know, several of Spike's earlier projects, School Days, Do the Right Thing, just as a session player. And when we were doing Mo Better Blues, Spike heard me playing something on a piano and asked if he could use it. And then we recorded it just as a solo trumpet piece. And then he asked if I could write a string arrangement for it, and I did. And Spike came over and he said, you have a talent for this and you have a future in the film business. And I said, okay, thank you. And I thought he was just being nice. But then he called me to do Jungle Fever, and we've been working together ever since.
You've done so many things together, from feature films to documentaries. What is it like to collaborate? Because I'm sure that if he works with you as much as he does, he respects your talents and what you bring to the table as much as you respect his. So how do you guys communicate about what you want to accomplish when it comes to scoring a film?
There are general things, I mean, that Spike talked about when we first started working together. In terms of how he loves melody, he loves very thematic music. And once we got that out of the way, then the next hurdle has always been to try to derive a sonic palette for each film that's slightly different from the one that we're currently working on. We always talk about instrumentation, you know, the sound that we're going for. And we just kind of take it from there. I mean, Spike is a cinematic visionary, you know. So, you know, with those few simple requirements that I just talked to you about, they are very demanding, actually, because, you know, while he may want thematic music, sometimes those themes may get in the way of dialogue, and they have posed challenges for me in the past.
Terrence, when some people think about movie music, they think, okay, well, these are a couple songs I'll buy for a soundtrack, or this is just the mustard and relish on the side, or, you know, a little condiment, or it's not even important, I don't even listen to it. How do you think of the music?
It varies from director to director and film to film, actually. But, you know, mostly with Spike always views his music as being a separate character, a whole nother piece to the puzzle, if you will. And he's always paid a lot of respect to the music, you know, not only mine, but the incidental music as well.
When you were faced with either the dailies or the rough cut or the script, how do you think about story?
Oh, you have to. You have to think about the story. You have to think about the big picture, because within any story there's an arc, and you have to make sure that the music enhances those places that need to be enhanced within that arc. You have to stay within the context of the story, but at the same time, there could be many variables. So I'm constantly thinking about the big picture, you know, not necessarily what the music should do at any given point, but where is it going, you know, where is it ultimately going to end up?
We've been talking a lot about the marriage between film and story and the music that you create. So why don't you tell us why the themes for 25th Hour and Inside Man worked for those films? Let's listen to a little bit from the 25th Hour. What about that really resonated with you? Why did you create it?
Well, I mean, when you listen to some of the music in 25th Hour, you know, Spike wanted to make sure that that music kept you in a post 9/11 New York. And so in my mind, that meant bagpipes, that meant Irish flutes, which represented New York Police Department and the Fire Department. It also meant to me that there was Arabic percussion and Arabic vocals that could have been used, which represented Al-Qaeda. And in various scenes throughout, you know, 25th Hour, you'll hear those elements, you know, throughout any given scene, which subliminally should keep you in the mindset that this is after 9/11. And it gives a certain type of flavor to the film.
What about Inside Man?
Inside Man is a little different in that, you know, Denzel's character is kind of like an old school cop, you know, so hence the R&B type of groove that you will hear under the main theme in some various spots in that particular film. I tried to draw upon some of the old school R&B grooves to kind of give him more of a flavor, because to me his character reminded me of some of my uncles, you know,
mm-hmm.
guys who were very serious about what they did, you know, and very good at their jobs, but also loved their music.
What's the benefit and what's the risk of trying to do film work? I mean, I'm sure that on some level there's only 24 hours in a day,
uh-huh.
and you have to make decisions about where you're going to put your time. How do you, for example, make those decisions?
Well, the thing about doing film work is that the limitations are the things that actually make you creative, you know, because not having the type of time you would really want to write this music, it forces you to make choices. And it forces you to, you know, come to the point where you have to live with those choices. And the more you do it, the better you become at it, you know. And my background as a jazz musician has always aided me in that regard, being able to think quickly on my feet. But at the same time, you know, it's made me learn how to really organize my time. You know, when I get a film, the first thing I try to do is break it down structurally. I try to, you know, identify certain thematic things that may occur. And then once I get all of those things set aside in my mind, structurally and how the school should evolve, then it makes scoring it that much easier, actually.
In a 1994 interview for Downbeat magazine, you said, writing for film is fun, but nothing can beat being a jazz musician, playing a club, playing a concert. Mm-hmm. Do you still think that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, live performance for me has always been where it's at. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, there are different forms of expression, so they all have their pluses and minuses. You know, the film thing allows me to be creative, you know, with different sonic textures, different size ensembles, and different musical genres. Whereas, you know, the immediacy of playing with a band is something totally different, you know, because the guys may throw something at me musically and then I'll respond, which will make us go in a certain musical direction one night, which will be different from the night prior to it and probably will yet be different the next night. So that kind of excitement, that kind of creative energy is something that I've always yearned and I've always cherished, you know. So I have a lot of fun playing live.
Terrence Blanchard, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you, as always.
Terrence Blanchard is an internationally renowned jazz trumpeter, bandleader, composer, and film score writer. We spoke to him while he was on the road touring from Gainesville, Florida.
Let's start.
Imagine a civil war ripping apart your country, and imagine you lost everything you knew and loved. Would you be able to reach inside yourself and find the strength to sing?
You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land. You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land.
Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars Band did just that. They came together as fighting closed in on the nation's capital in 1999. The musicians were forced to flee to a refugee camp. The All-Stars wrote songs there to pass the time, and eventually the musicians got their hands on some instruments. Since then, a film crew made a documentary about their journey. The band has cut a record and taken their music around the world. Tonight, the Refugee All-Stars are performing in Los Angeles, and two of the band members are here with me in our NPR West studios. Ruben Kuruma and Black Nature, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Yeah, I'm very glad to meet you guys, because one of the themes that seems to unite us is how music can bring together people who are in times of trouble. What was it, Ruben, I'll start with you, that music helped you deal with during the time that you had to also deal with war?
Well, I was a musician before the war, and so when I was forced to quit my country, we came to a nearby country called Guinea, and then we registered as refugees, you know. And when we started playing music in the refugee camp, it's like, you know, it's like we have something to do, you know, and then it really helped us to forget about what has happened to us, you know. And then we found out that people really always come around us when we play our music.
All them suck from the poor sufferers of my land. I got low, well, and cry. Well, well, me I go well. Well, yeah, for the homeless man.
Your wife, Grace, is also one of the founding members of the group. What's it like to have gone through all of these things with her, but also to perform with her?
Ever since we started the idea of making a group, she's always supporting me, you know. And so, well, that's how she became a musician, because she saw that I was alone. And there was nobody to at least support me. And when I started with her alone. When I sing, then she responded. So it's like we started it together.
Smile, you smile, you smile. Thinking about some positive changes.
Black Nature, how did you join the group, and what were you going through at the time?
Well, to start with, when we had the civil war way back in our country, then I fled into the next neighbor country. I was in the refugee camp, and Mr. Ruben also was in the refugee camp, as he was saying. And he was my teacher when I was in the refugee camp, you know. And
what did he teach you?
Well, he was teaching me, was it math?
Math language.
Yeah, he was teaching me different subjects, you know. And I was so stubborn when I was in school with him, you know. But he's a man that I used to admire a lot. Whenever I seen him started playing music, holding the guitar with friends, I would be like, come around there and listen to what they're doing, you know, and trying to get into it, you know. Then he thought that, oh, this boy, if I bring him up and try to incorporate with him, I think he will be somebody perfect in future tomorrow.
Oh, what a big blessing that we have learned. We've been away too long from home. Oh, what a big blessing that we have learned. To be treated in a strange land. Oh, Mr. Man, let us forgive and forget.
When I was in my country, I used to see my family and hang out with friends and live happily, you know. But when I found myself in the refugee camp by myself and my grandmom, and she is an old woman, you know, she can take care of me, you know. And I was like just doing my own thing. Of course, I was like totally traumatized because of what I've seen, what I saw.
When you say what you saw, what does that mean?
Like the horrible things that happened, like killed people in front of me, and they killed my father in front of me, you know, and like burning of houses, you know, raping, you know. I saw all this difficulties in my life, you know, so I was like totally traumatized, you know. But when I find music, then it's like a therapy. It helps my trauma a lot.
What's the favorite song that you've ever written, maybe something you've written with Ruben?
Well, the favorite song that I have ever liked in my life is called Weapon Conflict. You know, it's actually a song that talks about what is going on in the country, like people that have power, when they get into fight, the civilians will suffer because they have no power and they have nowhere to go, you know, so they will suffer the consequences.
A weapon conflict for the sake of power.
Will you sing it again?
A weapon
sing
conflict
it
for the sake of power.
Again and again.
So Sierra Leone has held national elections, and there's a international court that's indicted some of the people that were implicated in the war. Do you feel, and Black Nature, I'll go to you first and then you, Ruben, do you feel like things are on the right path for Sierra Leone? Do you have hope for your families who are there and for everyone there?
Well, at this point in time, I feel confident. Our country, it was in a darkness like for over 20 years. And recently, when we had the new government, and I heard about good things, like the country have started having light, you know, and I think it's amazing, and it makes me excited, and that just tells me that the country is gonna come back the way it was.
Ruben,
we are very much happy that we've got peace. And then an election has just been conducted. And the current president, I think he's very much hardworking. Because our country, which has been in darkness for 20 years, has been lit. And I believe that because the period of time, he just came within 3 months, he was able to fix up the light. So I'm very optimistic that he's going to at least be a good leader and then work for the country.
Well, Ruben and Black Nature, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ruben Karuma and Black Nature are bandmates in the group Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars, and they join me here at our NPR West studios. That's News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel and Siabwadi produced the show. Sasha Woodruff edits, and Devin Robbins is our director. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Our drive engineers are Marcia Caldwell and Carlos Asensio. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Jeffrey Bennett, Roy Hurst, Christopher Johnson, Kenya Young, and Anthea Raymond. Paige Lindell and Drew Tewksbury are our interns. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Next week, four primaries and a caucus. A look ahead at Tuesday's Republican and Democratic contest in Washington, Wisconsin, and Hawaii. I get a